Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 28 of the Playoff Push Podcast. I'm your host, Jack Dobbins, and today I'm joined by a very special guest, the voice of the Baltimore Orioles, Mr. Jeff Arnold. How are we today?
Jack, I'm doing great. Excited to be part of your podcast and to be catching up with a future young star in this broadcasting business.
It's an honor to be called that from you. You know, that's a huge title to hold.
Well, I'm thinking good thoughts for you, man. I think it's really cool that you're doing this podcast and you're in your senior year right now at Holy Ghost Prep. And if you can get these kinds of reps, it's invaluable. I mean, I didn't start doing this until I actually was in college and I fell into it by accident. But I always love doing these podcasts with guys and girls that have a goal and start on it really early.
Yeah, you've had a pretty solid path to get to where you are now, starting out in the minor leagues in around 2012 and slowly climbing up through college basketball and other minor league opportunities before eventually landing with Baltimore in 2020. Do you have any advice in general for up and coming sports broadcasters like myself and, you know, the friends that I have that try to work together to get advancing in the business?
You know, I'd say that start as early as you can, like you're doing right now. I think that maybe my path is unconventional, but it worked for me. And that's the nice thing about being a broadcaster. It's not like being a doctor or a lawyer where you have to go through this stage and this stage and this stage and this stage. With a broadcaster, there are any number of ways to skin the cat. And if you look at actually our broadcast roster with the Orioles, we all did it in completely different ways. Some of us, such as Jim Palmer, came right off the field and went straight into the booth. Some, like Ben McDonald, wanted to raise his family first, and then he kind of worked his way into the broadcast booth. Some did the minor league thing, like me and Kevin Brown and Melanie Newman, and some did the major market radio thing, and they would do play-by-play on the sides, such as Brett Hollander. And it's what makes this industry so great is the collective experiences that we gain along the way, which help inform us when we hopefully get that big break and that big opportunity. And just, I think, makes us more well-rounded as a broadcast group. But I would say start as early as you can. Anything that can get you in front of a microphone is a good thing. I know that a lot of people, they want to be play-by-play people or host talk shows or whatever. But if somebody says to you, can you anchor the news tonight? Say yes. If somebody says, can you be the sideline reporter for this football game? Just say yes. If somebody says, can you do color commentary for this volleyball game? Just say yes. And you're not going to know everything about these jobs, but you're going to learn how to be a broadcaster. And that entails doing a lot of different things, gaining a lot of different experiences. And it's a kinesthetic exercise, broadcasting. It's, you can watch a lot of people, and I certainly have, and I'm sure you do too, where you watch what they do and it gives you some ideas of maybe things you're going to try when you do your broadcast or your podcast or whatever. But there's nothing quite like doing it. I'd also say if you can read a lot and read a lot of different things, like every day, like I read news, I read sports, I watch different things, I listen to different podcasts, I even read books every once in a while, though some people may dispute that. No, I'm just kidding. But, you know, find stuff that interests you. And if you like to read fiction, I'm more of a nonfiction type reader. It's just where my interests are. But read fiction, read nonfiction. One of the most valuable classes, actually, that I took when I got to college, too, and this is something that maybe some people can find useful, is I took an acting class, which was supposed to be, I think, a distribution requirement, but it beat art history or something like that, which I never wanted to do. And I went to this acting class, and it proved to be one of the most valuable courses I took my entire college career, because it taught me pacing and working with people and delivering a monologue and just a lot of small things that as broadcasters, you need to learn how to do. It also taught me how to ad lib. So if you forget your lines, you got to figure out what to do. I took also improv, which was, I think, a really nice thing. Kevin Brown has done the same thing. And it also gave me some ways to be more creative on the air, because that's what we're trying to do when we broadcast, is be as creative as possible. And sometimes you're going to get the 12-2 game against the Yankees, and you're going to have to figure out, all right, how are we going to navigate the next 5 or 6 innings of this thing? And sometimes it's experiences taking acting classes or something funny that you read in the paper the other day, or maybe it's just remembering something or some random reference from all your life experiences that can help you make it more entertaining for others. So Those are just a couple of things. And I'd also say, whatever you're doing, don't get frustrated, especially at the beginning. This is really hard. And it took me a long time to figure it out. I spent 8 years in the minors. I needed all 8 years to be ready for the majors. And I'm glad that I had those experiences. So don't get frustrated easily and just realize that the harder you work and the longer you stay in it, the better chance that good things are going to happen.
I mean, yeah, I'm a high school senior and I've been calling games since 7th grade. So I've been in it for already a minute.
Incredible.
I'm getting all the reps.
Incredible.
On Friday, I had the honor of calling play-by-play for our guard, Ace Varela, hit 1,000 points, the 8th player in school history to do so. It was an honor to call that. I had probably one of my best clips ever. It was just great.
Awesome. Yeah, that's the type of stuff that, I mean, 7th grade, that's incredible. I'm sure you were probably also like calling like backyard baseball games
Oh,
and stuff
100%.
off the television since you were like in 3rd or 4th grade too.
All
Hey,
my
it's
friends'
great.
Madden games. My friends' Madden games. Oh, my goodness.
It's great. And you know what? Actually, Virginia Tech, I've seen Bill Roth, who longtime broadcaster for them, been in the Virginia Sports Hall of Fame. He actually teaches a class, and I know that's what he does. He puts Madden on, and that's how they learn how to broadcast. And it's a really valuable tool. So anything you can do to get yourself ready for broadcast, even if it's not getting a chance to broadcast at your school, but maybe you'll learn down the road, this is what I want to do. Take it. Just do it and have fun with it.
All about reps. I hear that from every broadcaster I've talked to. It's all about reps.
It's exactly right. Reps are the most important thing. The more you do it, the more stuff that's going to come top of mind. And every day I do my prep for games, and I have all this stuff in my notes, but plenty of times like the broadcast will take me one place and I just go down that road if I know that I can. And that's sometimes the advantage of it, because at the very beginning, some stuff may not come to you right away, but the longer you do it, the words come a little bit easier, different ideas come to you a little bit easier, and you're just more relaxed.
Yeah, totally. I mean, just it's all reps and all the way you can work on improving your craft. And of course, in baseball, these last few years, we've had a lot of changes implemented into the rules to really change the way not only the game's played, but the way the game is called. Has there been any change in the way you broadcast games for such as the pitch clock or bigger bases that adjust the words you use and the way you phrase it?
Question. I would say that when I work radio with an analyst, I'm a little bit more cognizant of being a little more concise with how I broadcast. When you're working with on radio with the Orioles, we do two play-by-play people. So I'll do my innings and then Brett will usually do his innings. And then on television, it's different. You're working with an analyst the entire time. But every once in a while, I'll work with an analyst on a radio broadcast, and I want to make sure to give them as much real estate as they need. Then McDonald and I were working together, I think, when the pitch clock came in, and he'll sometimes do some spring training games on radio with me. And then also he'll do some postseason radio with us at times. And I remember like the first game, it was a bit of a challenge to try and find space to get him in. So what I would do is I'd be a little bit more concise and maybe cut a thing or two out just to give him the extra room to say what he wants to say, because he knows so much and people love hearing from him. But outside of that, not a whole lot of differences, especially when you're doing a two play-by-play person system for that we do, or when it's a play-by-play person and an analyst and it's on television, because people can see that. On radio, I think you need to be a little bit more concise, but the most part, I think the pitch clock is great because it's more exciting for the fans. The games don't go as long. The quality of play is better. You're seeing more balls put into play a lot more quicker. And I'm not trying to overfill. I think that before the pitch clock came in, it would just be these 3 hour and 20 minute slogs where you're just trying to find any little note or nugget that you can to keep the game going. And nobody wants to watch 4 hour games that are 6-1. Like, nobody wants to watch
Oh,
that.
yeah.
So I think it's much better for how the game intended to be. And at one point there was no pitch clock and you still had the type of games that we have right now. But really, I'd say that it just makes me a better broadcaster, and it prevents me from having to either talk too much and over talk, or to just talk too little and under talk. And then you lose people and they're not quite as interested.
Yeah, do you believe that the pitch clock is stunting pitcher injuries, or do you think that's just a lack of sample size?
I don't think that it's one thing that has to do with the pitcher injuries. I think it's a number of things. But I think that without the pitch clock, I don't know kind of what people's appetite for baseball would be. I mean, a lot of people were starting to get tired of it. And then plenty of people came back to the game once this thing got put into place. But the pitcher injuries, I think, is the number one question, Jack, that we're all trying to figure out. And people from Major League Baseball and different folks are all looking at it. I think, and this is just my opinion, I think a lot of it has to do with the nature of pitching these days, which is max effort every pitch all the time. And I'm not just talking about during games. I'm talking about in spring training games. I'm talking about in off-season bullpens. I'm talking about year-round. And whenever you're going 100% or trying to do more than that for spanning spring training and the off season when you're training all the way into the regular season and sometimes even the playoffs, you're going to have guys get hurt because the way that the body is, it wasn't meant to go max effort 100% of the time. And I think that it's just the style of pitching in this day and age, which is really the greatest cause, because Greg Maddux didn't need to throw 93, 94 miles an hour in his first spring training bullpen and wasn't looking at all the different spin metrics and things like that.
My dad
Whereas in
always raves
today,
about Greg Maddux. He says he's still the greatest
yeah.
pitcher he's ever seen.
And he was great, but every pitcher can be great for a different reason. And Jim Palmer was great for one reason. Greg Maddux was great for one reason. Randy Johnson was great in the same era, but doing it a completely different way. So I don't think there's any one thing that you can point to, but I'd say that if it, for me, number one would be the nature of the game and how every pitcher, starting with their off-season routine all the way up through the start of the actual season, is just going 100% every time.
Yeah, and I think the velocity metrics really show that the way it's been steadily climbing up and climbing up and climbing up. And it's less so pitchers now just worrying about, like, cool breaking stuff and just being able to locate. It's just how fast can I throw it down the middle of the plate?
And it's a scary thing because that type of stuff carries down to colleges, high schools, youth leagues, little leagues, you
Oh,
name it,
yeah.
because everybody wants to do what the major league guys are doing. And so I think what you have to factor in is that not only is the pitcher injury something that is affecting major league pitchers, by the way they pitch, it's affecting players that might be 10, 11, and 12 years old. And that's definitely not a good thing.
100%. I mean, when I used to play baseball, I, retired my sophomore year, but I didn't throw fast. I don't know if you remember this player, but I used to model my game after Chaz Rowe. He used to pitch for Tampa. I don't know if you remember him and his disgusting slider, quite literally the greatest pitch I've ever seen in the modern day. It's just so great. And I used to model my pitching after him, but I wasn't worried about velocity. I was just worried about seeing how I can trick the hitter, whether it be mentally or physically.
And Chaz Rowe, former Oriole as
Oh,
well, pitched
yeah.
for the Rays, as you mentioned too. But no, and pitchers will find what pitch works best for them, and they'll throw it and throw it and throw it and throw it to try and get results. And for a lot of pitchers, it has worked. But there's always that risk of injury, and you can't help your team when you're on the IL.
100%. Now let's switch gears over to the Orioles specifically. Of course, that is who you spend most of your time broadcasting for. And since you got there in 2020, this Orioles team has entirely shifted. They've been evolving exponentially year by year by year. And since you got to Baltimore, my question is, how have you seen the team identity change from a perspective that the casual fan wouldn't see?
They got there in 2020. They were in year two of their rebuild, and it was kind of the land of opportunity. That's what we heard a lot, where a lot of players coming up to the major leagues didn't have very much experience. Some were journeymen, and it was their opportunity to prove themselves. And if they didn't play well one day, chances are they were going to get another chance the next day or the day after that or what have you. And it was a great opportunity for a lot of different guys. And some guys cashed in on those types of chances. Cedric Mullins, for instance, had that incredible season where he hits 30 home runs and has 30 stolen bases. And you don't see that very often. And there were plenty of highlight moments like that. John Means' no-hitter was another one that comes to mind that happened in my second
I
year,
miss
which
John
was.
Means so much. I have to say, I missed watching him pitch so much.
He knows how to pitch, and that's what's so great about him. But no, a lot of guys had their chances to come up and to figure it out during the rebuilding years. And the Orioles Super Bowl every year was the amateur player draft. And started in 2019 when you draft Adley Rutschman. And not far after that, you got Gunnar Henderson. And then you'd bring on Heston Kerstad and Jordan Westberg and Jackson Holliday and many others. And the Orioles hit time and time again on these young prospects. And you know, some of it started at stuff like the alternate site, which we start to forget a little bit right now, and how for players that were at the very beginning of their minor league careers, part of how they stayed with it and how they kept getting their work in, were going to different teams, alternate sites, and that certainly helped guys like Rutschman and Henderson. But sort of as you were playing at the major league level, a lot of times I felt like we were also watching what Gunnar and Adley and Kerstad and some of these other players were doing. Grayson Rodriguez, another one. DL Hall is another one before he got traded. We were always keeping one eye on that too, because we were like, that's where the future really is. And I give Michael Elias all the credit in the world. Hitting on draft picks is not easy to do. And Adley
Especially in
Rutschman,
baseball, especially in
yeah,
baseball.
exactly. And Adley Rutschman hit on him. He's been an all-star twice. Gunnar Henderson, so many teams wish that they would have drafted him and not let him slip to the Orioles, but he's one of the game superstars right now. Jordan Westberg, I think, has a chance to be an all-star for many years, and I think is the heart and soul of the Orioles team. But it took some time for all of them to get up there. And, you know, 2020 was a weird year. 21, I think kind of the highlight was, you know, the Means no-hitter is sort of the demarcation line, where after that things started to go downhill. But you realized that and you understood that. And then in 2022, when Adley came up, that's when the Orioles started to turn things around, and Gunnar would be up later on in that year. And the Orioles were the last team out of the playoffs in that given season. And it was pretty cool because you're like, we're a year ahead of time. And then you go to the next year and you win 101 games. And then this past year, you made the playoffs. But you know, I think what you've seen is a team that is trying to figure it out, a lot of players that are super young. And now some of those young players, when I got there, are turning into clubhouse leaders, which some in the space of a rebuild aren't always going to get to that point. But I think what's so cool about it is it's homegrown players, it's homegrown talent, and as the fans have kind of grown with the different players on the Orioles, they've been growing with these guys ever since they came into the system, because fans would go out and watch them play in the minor leagues. Now they watch them play at Camden Yards on a nightly basis. And I just don't think there are many teams that can say they have the type of relationship with their players as Orioles fans do.
Yeah, this team's like super homegrown. I haven't actually looked at the percentages of, acquired via trade or free agency or via draft, but I assume it's probably among, top three or at least top five in the league.
Yeah, I mean they are very fortunate that they have the development system that they do. And it starts with Michael Elias and what he's done in drafting the right people and looking at the right things. And you know, he had a lot of experience doing that, first when he was with St. Louis and then when he went to Houston, and he had an idea as to what he wanted to look for. And now that you hit on those players, as the Orioles are not getting quite the type of picks that they had before, because they're one of the best teams in baseball right now, it gives them a farm system that is still very strong. And as you know, over the course of a baseball season, you're going to need a lot of people. And when people come into spring training and they can say, I can't believe this person was sent down, I can't believe this person wasn't on the team, I always say, just wait. It's a long season. If we see them here, especially if they're pitchers, we're probably going to be seeing them at some point over the 162 game season.
Definitely. This Orioles team, of course, very, very young, also probably among the youngest teams in baseball, whether it be on the current roster or in the minors, excluding Gunnar Henderson. I have to say that, exclude Gunnar in this question. What young player do you think will have the most impact on the Orioles roster next year?
I think it's Jordan Westberg for me. Westbrook came up in 23, and it kind of like a lot of players, it took him some time to get his feet under him. And I know that he wanted to improve on hitting higher velocity better. We heard him say that at the very beginning of the year. I just loved it when we got to spring training last year and just talking to Jordan. He kind of was under the impression that he had to make the team and he wasn't sure that that was going to happen. And then you talk to some people and they're like, he's on the team. I don't understand why he does it this way, but he wanted to prove himself. And I love that about him. I think that his best trait is his intensity and his focus. You'd be hard pressed to find somebody who's as focused as Jordan Westbrook is. And focus is something I think that we can all work on no matter what we're doing. But I'd say for Jordan, it probably started with the way he was raised and being accustomed to paying attention to details and doing the little things right and not taking at bats off. And it's so hard to do that when you play a season that's as long as a baseball season. But I think he's the heart and soul of the team. I love how he competes. I love the intensity that he brings to every at bat. I love how he never gives an at bat away. And maybe he'll get you a big hit, but he might strike out and force the pitcher to throw 12 pitches, and then somebody comes up right after him and they hit a home run, and it's because he wore the pitcher out before the pitcher made a mistake to the next guy in the order. I think he could be a guy who is a big part of this team for a long time. And Brian Roberts said this to me when we were
Oh, wow.
doing a series in Tampa Bay earlier this year. He said he reminds me in Westberg of what Dustin Pedroia was like for the Boston Red
Ooh.
Sox. And I never forgot him saying that.
I mean, this Orioles team is just so loaded with the young talent. Westberg's a guy who, a lot of people have been super high on, and some people not so high due to some, early struggles. But I've seen the ramp up. I've seen him slowly beginning to progress.
That's the thing, Jack, is that now it is harder to hit major league pitching more than ever. And we talked about it a little bit earlier on. It's because pitchers are going to these pitching labs and they're working on their pitch designs and they're throwing harder than they ever have. And you're seeing pitchers for as short of a period as you ever did. Like, you're not seeing pitchers working in the seventh and eighth innings consistently anymore. You're not seeing many complete games across. And what that means is if you're a young player, you're going from a right-hander who's throwing 95 to 98 for the first five, maybe six innings, and then you're going into just matchup mode the rest of the way, where if you're down by a run or two, every high-leverage reliever is throwing at least 95, 96, throwing from different arm angles, usually has some kind of nasty wipeout breaking ball. And so when players who are young struggle, I'm never surprised by it. And you'll see, and I've seen this with the Orioles fans, and you see this with every fan across every team. They're like, well, so-and-so's coming up, and they're a bust. They're not doing this or whatever. They're not performing like you thought they could. And I'm like, that's not how this works. Do you see what they're facing? Do you see how challenging this is? So I always expect some kind of a learning curve. Jackson Holliday had one this year, but what the best players show is that they learn from their mistakes and they learn from their experiences. Colton Cowles was nearly a rookie of the year this past year. He really had some problems the year prior. Jackson Holliday, he took his lumps at the very beginning. I thought he closed the season really strong. And I think that that's all you look for from young talent. That's why it's also important that you have some veteran players there as well who can explain this isn't easy and we have your back and we're here to help you make this adjustment up here.
Yeah, I have a little personal question here about another, I guess young Oriole that I had was super high on prior to him getting called up to the majors. Kind of a slow start. Hasn't been pitching badly, but I expected a bit more so far from him. Grayson Rodriguez, a guy who coming up, I thought had all the tools to really succeed at the major league level and has a 4.11 ERA so far in his career, which is solid, but not quite where I expected him to be. What do you see from Rodriguez and where do you think he'll go?
You know what? If you look at the first time he was in the major leagues, that's a big reason why he's got a 4.11 ERA. What I would do, and I don't have the calculator or baseball reference in front of me, is look at how his ERA was before he was sent down to AAA, and then look at it since he returned. Two completely different things. He's pitched at an all-star caliber level. After, we talk about hitters, pitchers are the same type of way. Trying to get used to major league hitting is really tough, especially if you're pitching inside the American League East. And with Grayson, he went down, he made his adjustments, he fixed some things mechanically. I think he also realized pitch mix, what he needed to do that worked up in the big leagues. And he had a great year. I feel like the only thing for Grayson just had to do with the injuries right now and staying healthy. If Grayson can stay healthy, I have no doubt that one day he can be an ace of the pitching staff. His stuff is that good. He's great at competing. It's just a matter, and he would tell you the same thing, of making sure that you can stay healthy through a whole year.
Great insight into the Baltimore Orioles from Mr. Jeff Arnold. And we're going to switch back for a couple final questions about your broadcasting career. One thing I never thought about was the Grayson Rodriguez thing being sent down and being called back up. I don't really know how I looked that up, but I kind of want to after we finish this recording. But my next question is, as a broadcaster, the broadcaster for the Baltimore Orioles, what's your favorite part of the job? Not necessarily on the microphone, but is it the prep? Is it getting to be down on the field and learning more about guys? What is your favorite part, excluding the actual broadcasting?
I think that it's getting to be with the different players and coaches. And also, and I'd say probably number one is getting to work with the people that I work with. We're really fortunate that we have a tight-knit group and we've been there together through the highs and the lows. I mean, we were all working together when the rebuild was going on. And there's nothing quite like making it to the other side when you see the years of the struggles and guys trying to figure it out. And then suddenly you get some of these young players who come up and you watch them grow and you grow yourself as a broadcaster and you grow with the fans, and just being in it has been really cool. But I'd say that the relationship and the bond that I've built with the members of our broadcast team is the coolest part of the job. Everybody has their own skills and gifts, and getting to learn from the likes of Ben McDonald and Jim Palmer, if you can't learn from guys like that, you're not going to learn from anybody. And to hear the different stories, and also to, build relationships with people like Brandon Hyde and Tim Cousins, a field coordinator, Drew French, a pitching coach. These are all good people. They're all really good at what they do, and they teach you a lot about the game. They make your life easier. We hopefully do the same for them. And it's not a guarantee that you're going to have people that you work with like that, but with the Orioles, we're really lucky that we do.
One of my favorite broadcasting booths in the entire league. And that's, some high praise coming from a Yankees fan, I do gotta say.
No, I appreciate it. I mean, our goal is to, and I take this phrase from Dave Wills, a late broadcaster for the Tampa Bay Rays, and he would always say, we're just trying to be good company. That's really what our goal is. And when we come into the booth, at least for me, my goal is to tell you what's going on, tell you the big picture stuff that's happening. Maybe shed a little bit of insight on some stuff that the fans are wondering. Maybe tell you something that you're not going to be able to read in an article, something that maybe is behind the scenes. And then also find ways to entertain you and make you enjoy it and make you laugh, because baseball is different than any other sport because the year is so long, and because you're going to get a mix of games that are great, and then you're going to get the clunkers. You're going to get clunkers where you win big and the clunkers where you lose big. It's just how baseball is. But we always want to make sure that no matter what the game is giving us, we're able to make it fun for the people that are watching or listening at home.
Is there any peculiar stat or something you do in your research that you like to bring up that most broadcasters might not think of?
An interesting question. I would say that from a stat perspective, our group kind of hits every spectrum that there is. Like, we will do the traditional stats, which everybody knows and understands. Sometimes we might do some of the advanced analytics stuff. I'm not a big wins above replacement guy. I will refer to it maybe every once in a while, but things such as, strikeout percentage or ERA plus or OPS plus. OPS, I think, is a big one across baseball right now, and I refer to that a lot. But, I don't know if there's any one given stat, but But I think what we're just trying to do is to give you through, if we use numbers, at least for me, if I use numbers, there's a reason why I'm doing it. I'm not just doing it to show you that I did my homework. I'm not doing it just to show you that I'm smart or anything like that. I'm doing it to help enlighten, like, this is what you need to know about where this player is and what they're doing, and can maybe explain why they're playing so well and sometimes maybe why they're not. And I think that we try and hit on a number of different things, or at least look at them. And sometimes when it comes to certain stats, they're just so challenging to explain. And some of them I don't even understand, to be really honest with you. But sometimes they're so hard to understand that what you'll just do is you'll kind of give the Cliff Notes version, or you'll put it in English that people can understand. And then usually the people that really are the stat heads that look into that type of stuff, they'll understand what you're referring to, and they'll be able to realize that you're on the same page as them.
That's super neat. We got about 1 minute left, so it's like a quick one final rapid fire question about one of my favorite segments you've ever had. Of course, that is the iconic hot dog segment. And my question is, if you had to get a ballpark dog with three things on it, what would you put on it and what's off limits?
You know what? I don't know. I mean, I'm not a big condiments guy on hot dogs, so I'm kind of boring in that sense.
Oh.
I guess I would do.
I mean, I guess nothing's also an acceptable answer. I didn't really think about
How
that.
about this? I would do chili, cheese, and maybe a little mustard. How about that?
Ooh, interesting. As long as there's no, like, what was it, chunky tomato, I think you said during that part of the
Yeah,
year.
that's yeah, exactly. I mean, listen, tomatoes are not meant to be on a hot dog. Though it's funny, when we were playing the White Sox this past year, and I asked Ben McDonald the age-old question of,
Yeah, that's
is
what
a
I'm
hot
referring
dog a
to.
sandwich, is it a sandwich or not? And he
I
said,
guess
I think
so.
it's a sandwich. There's bread. I'm like, there's bread. Does it insinuate that it's a sandwich? But no, like, I remember, like, we're there at Guaranteed Rate Field, and they're throwing tomatoes on hot dogs. I'm like, don't we have to draw the line somewhere? I mean,
Oh,
I kind
yeah.
of feel like that's a bridge too far, at least for me. But that's one of the cool things about baseball too, is you go to different ballparks, everybody has their own type of hot dog. You go to Texas, for instance, and they have one called the Boomstick, which is just this large, massive thing. I think we're trying to get Ribeye Reese, our producer engineer, to eat the thing by himself and see if he can make it through an entire game, maybe without passing out. But that's what makes baseball great, and that's why we love going from different park to different park and seeing what the whole spectrum of baseball and all the different cities have to offer.
You heard it here from Mr. Jeff Arnold. Again, thank you, Mr. Arnold, so much for hopping on this show. It was an honor to interview the 2023 Maryland Sportscaster of the Year Award winner. And I wish you all the best in your future endeavors. And I would also like to thank you guys, the listeners, to the Playoff Push Podcast for listening to episode 28 of this show. I'm so happy to be back recording on a consistent schedule. We have a great episode for you next week. Again, thank you so much for listening and have a great rest of your day.